qualify briefly. Requirements for chairing the meeting, Saturday night speaker meeting, are 1 year of continuous sobriety and attendance at a group conscious meeting, and I do have a 1 year of continuous sobriety, thanks to Alcoholics Anonymous and my higher power. And I have attended a group conscious meeting, which I highly recommend to everyone here. My name is Liz, and I'm an alcoholic, and I drank alcoholically from the very beginning, and I blacked out from the very beginning, and I knew that there was a solution because my father was an alcoholic, and I saw him get sober through Alcoholics Anonymous, but I did not want to be an alcoholic. It was the last place I wanted to be. This is the last house on the block for me. But when I wanted to quit, I couldn't, and I didn't know how to, and I had to surrender, and the only way to do that was to come in here and work these steps and to find a higher power and to surrender myself to that power and to do this deal and to do this thing one day at a time. And by doing that, I have been able to stay sober one day at a time and not drink one day at a time, by the grace of God. And, I have a great life today, and this program has given me a life worth living, and I'm just really grateful to be here tonight. And I am really thrilled about chairing a speaker meeting tonight. This is my first time doing it, and that's enough about me. So I'm going to go ahead and introduce our speaker. You're welcome. I'm glad I'm not. Let me just remind everyone to make sure that their phones are off right now and to refrain from moving around or talking while the speaker is sharing. My speaker tonight is someone that I've known for, I think, about 4 years, or probably about 5 years now. When I came, I have time in the program before, and I came back in, and this time I came back in, and I'm in another outside program that's called Professional Resource Network that I'm in that helps me keep my license to work in the medical profession, and this is how I met this person. And it's kind of ironic because when I met him in the group, we actually worked in the same professional group together, and we didn't even know that. And I kind of little new bits of the story, but I'm really kind of interested to hear the rest of the story, and I really respect his program because I get to hear how he works it every week, and I've seen him go through things and not pick up a drink over it, difficult situations in the last few years, and just, you know, take it one day at a time. And I have a lot of respect for him, so I'm going to turn it over to Ken. So thank you.
My name's Ken Byerly. I'm an alcoholic. I'm not real big on microphones, so I may stand a little bit back. Yeah, as Liz was saying, I'm a doctor. I've been practicing in Osceola County for 25 years. 20 years emergency medicine. The last 5 years I've been at the health department at Osceola County. I just want to start off by thanking Liz for having me talk tonight. You know, the program's about personal growth, and a lot of times, you know, it's easy for us to see personal growth in other people. It's hard for us to see it in ourselves. And because of Liz, I had an opportunity to see a little bit of that in myself because, of course, when she asked me to speak, my first inclination was to jump up, smack her upside the head and say, hell no, and then run away before she could hit me back. But I didn't do that. I said, of course, Liz, I'll be happy to talk. The other reason, you know, I never leave Osceola County. Never. So, you know, that this again is another example, I guess, of some personal growth that I made it up here. In any case, before I get started, you know, I always like to say a little preface about what I'm going to be talking about. To understand my story, you have to realize one thing. My story is not a story of success. It's one of failure. If you're going to understand my drinking and why I'm here in Alcoholics Anonymous, that's one thing you have to realize from the start. As far as I'm concerned, before I got to AA, my life was a failure. There are people that say that I believe that alcoholics are born. There are people that say that genetics loads the gun and the environment pulls the trigger. My trigger got pulled a lot, as you'll hear. Any case, my mom was an alcoholic. She was a single mother. My father was what I kindly refer to as a serial monogamist. He was old-fashioned. He believed that if you went to bed with a woman, you married her. As a consequence, he had 9 wives. My mother was his third wife. My father didn't play a big role in my life, needless to say. He was busy moving on to other wives. In any case, because of my mother's alcoholism, my childhood was, far from perfect. In fact, it pretty much was pretty emotionally abusive for me. Number one, I was a skinny kid, a sickly kid. People used to tell me that if I stood sideways and stuck out my tongue, I looked like a zipper. We were living in a not-so-nice neighborhood. I was blind, basically, from birth. I've worn glasses since I was, like, 4 years old. I've been an avid reader since I was a little kid. You wander around a not-so-nice neighborhood with glasses, skinny, carrying books with you. You're like putting a little target on your back saying, why don't you beat me up? And that happened on a regular basis, which made me very terrified as a child. I was paranoid. I learned to isolate at an early age. I never left the house unless I had to, because I was afraid if I left, I was going to get beaten up or something bad was going to happen. Back then, they referred to these kind of people as juvenile delinquents, JDs. They didn't always beat you up, you know. They'd follow you, and they'd talk about doing stuff, and sometimes they'd do it, and sometimes they wouldn't. Sometimes they just break your glasses. Sometimes they just rip your books up. Not physically hurt you, but, you know, kind of make you really worried about your own safety. And my mother being an alcoholic and me being a sickly child, I really don't remember my first drink. When I was sick, my mother was a firm believer that anything could be cured with an ounce of whiskey, some honey, and lemon juice. And I have to admit, it did make me feel better, and to the point where soon I didn't really have to be sick. I was sick enough that, if I wanted a drink, I just kind of acted sick, and I could get one. Because of my childhood, I lived in kind of a fantasy world. Children don't have a lot of defenses for things, so they kind of go into their heads and live in their heads. I was drinking regularly by the time I was 8, or as regularly as an 8-year-old can drink, which was, 2 or 3 times a week. My mom always kept a bottle of Seagram 7 underneath the sink, and I was, doing this, get the bottle, sneak a little Seagram 7, fill it up with some water. She never seemed to notice, probably because she was drinking a lot anyway. She worked as a waitress and a bartender in Indianapolis. So, and we were, because of our alcoholism, we were fairly low on the economic scale. Breakfast was a cup of coffee. Lunch was mayonnaise sandwiches. Dinner was generally stewed tomatoes and macaroni. Occasionally, we'd have hamburger. Our lights were turned off on a regular basis for non-payment. We went through winters without any fuel oil. So like I said, it wasn't really a great childhood. Because my mother was Catholic, and part of the divorce settlement, my father agreed to pay and send us to Catholic school. So I was going to a private Catholic school during this time. This was not a good thing. If you live in the neighborhood I lived in and you go off to a private school, that gives people another reason to kind of single you out. And, of course, any of you who went to Catholic school back in the 60s and that, the nuns were not exactly your friend. You know, they really went out of their way to abuse you, trying to make you more godly and that. I never did my homework. I was always getting in trouble. I was a daydreamer. You know, I was never paying attention in class, always daydreaming. Today they would say I had attention deficit disorder and probably put me on some medication. Back then, the nuns just kind of whacked you upside the head and told you to pay attention. The only thing that really helped was, like I said, I was an avid reader. I don't remember learning how to read. I've always known how to read. By the time I was 4, I had a library card. You know, just one of those things. I don't remember learning to read. I don't know how I learned how to read, but that's the way it was. When I went to school, when I was in the first grade, I was reading on a third grade level. When I was in the third grade, I was reading on an eighth grade level. You know, and it was kind of that way all through my educational years. When I was 12, my mom's alcoholism kind of progressed to the point where the place we were living, we lost that house, and we're moving to a slightly lower rung on the scale of the social ladder. My uncle, at that point, her family was very large. She had 9 brothers and sisters. So her brother, my Uncle Bill, came down to rescue us. And he brought us to Kissimmee, Florida. He was a developer from California. He was one of those guys that knew about Disney before anybody in Central Florida knew about Disney. And so he came to Disney in the early 60s and started buying a property when it was still cheap. He happened to buy a ranch down in Kissimmee on what's called King's Highway, a 240-acre ranch. And so he brought us down to Kissimmee to live there and, quote, take care of the property, which was a godsend. Don't get me wrong, you know. For the first time in my life, my mom actually got a daytime job. She kind of moderated her drinking. We actually had food, electricity, lights, you know. It was nice. Plus, the King's Highway in Kissimmee is named for the guy who used to draw Gasoline Alley, and this was his ranch. It was a comic strip back in the 30s. So the house we were staying in was very nice. Had a library, built-in bookshelves. It had a bar, separate room bar that was all set up. It had maid's quarters, chauffeur's quarters. It had an Olympic-sized swimming pool. Had a boathouse with 2 slips for the boats. I had a guest house, a summer house, kennels. You know, it was nice. So anyway, moved to Kissimmee. That was like a major culture shock. Because back then, Kissimmee, you know, Osceola County, before all the development took place, there were like 8,000 people in town. 3,000 people were in St. Cloud. There were about 18,000 people total in the county. 1 Spanish family. That was the Spanish teacher for the high school. Needless to say, coming from a private Catholic school that was segregated, and you moved to Kissimmee, which still had segregation, segregated high schools and everything, I didn't initially fit in too well with the rednecks. But that was, you know, I'm very adaptable, so that I quickly learned to accommodate this cultural shock. And I did well in school. You know, I was always college prep. But, you know, back in those days, there was really very little to do in Kissimmee or St. Cloud or Osceola County. excuse my language, but there was really only three things to do. That was drink, fight, or fuck. I mean, those were your basic choices, you know. So I fit in real well to the culture, at least from the drinking aspect, not so much from the fighting and the other stuff. Because I wasn't a real ladies' man by any means, but drinking I could do. So I went to high school there. I was college prep. I took 3 years of biology, 2 years of chemistry, a year of physics, honors English. By the time I was 17, I'd been arrested for public intoxication, driving while intoxicated, and possession of drugs. You know, what can I say? I think the police had it out for me. I really do. It was a small town. You know, God knows, they were into everybody's business. And I know this for a fact, because after I left Kissimmee, I have never been arrested in my life. So in any case, I was always kind of real variable in my schooling. I get an A one quarter and F the next, which didn't really bother me because, you know, I like to say I graduated from high school with a perfect 2.0. You know, to kind of, and forgive me, but, you know, drugs are part of my story because of the era I grew up in. But I am an alcoholic. I've not done any drugs since 1982. But just for example, you know, I initially, I was kind of the, if you're familiar with Leave It to Beaver, I was kind of the Eddie Haskell of Kissimmee. Well-dressed, very polite. Well, well-dressed compared to the average person in Kissimmee. You know, they usually wore cowboy boots and jeans and cowboy shirts with the little silverly buttons on them. And I'd wear my Gantt shirts and my Hager pants and my dress. You know, so I looked good next to these guys. But I was very polite, very well-mannered, until things kind of happened. You know, my reputation kind of grew. My mother, we had the high school graduation party for the seniors when I was a sophomore on our ranch. And that caused a major scandal in the town. There were several unwanted pregnancies that resulted from that graduation party. Numerous motor vehicle accidents with cars winding up in ditches or against trees. As a result of that, my mother was actually fired from her job. One time, this friend of mine, Philip Scully, his parents had left to go to Atlanta. And, of course, they said what they always said when they left, whatever you do, don't let Ken Byerly in this house. And, of course, as soon as they left, I came right over. And we decided we would go looking for some mushrooms. For those of you not familiar with mushrooms, they grow in cow shit. And Kissimmee at that time was surrounded by cow shit. So we went out to get mushrooms, and we weren't content with, you know, a little bag. We got three grocery bags full of mushrooms. And we proceeded to have a little party. And unfortunately, as things go, his parents came back early. And when they walked in the house, there were people in every room of the house. And none of them were sober by any means. Not to mention that every pot and pan in their kitchen was destroyed because we had been cooking mushrooms and sauteed mushrooms and making mushroom shakes. And I'll never forget this man who lived across the street from Mr. Scully, Mr. Neer, came over. And they always used to commiserate with each other because Mr. Neer's son was a drummer in a rock and roll band. So they'd talk about how worthless their kids were. And Mr. Neer came over and told Mr. Scully, he says, Mr. Scully, he said, I don't know what to say. He said it was more than a party. It was some kind of hippie ritual. So that was kind of typical of my high school years. One time I went to pick up a young lady at her house to go on a date. I was always very polite. I always went to the house, went in, introduced myself to the parents, you know, wanted to make sure they knew that their daughter was safe. And I remember this one time I was walking up to the house, and I actually made it to the porch, when all of a sudden the screen door just kind of flew open, and her father came through the door and slammed me out into the lawn and told me that if I ever set foot on their property, I was going to be bodily hurt in a bad way. So needless to say, I left, and we rescheduled that date for a later time where it didn't require my meeting her parents. So anyway, I got done with high school. I wasn't planning on leaving Florida to go to school, so they had a little test back then called the American College Test, which I took. I drank a six-pack of beer and smoked a joint before the test because I believe the key to good test-taking is to be relaxed. I scored 385 out of 400. Back in those days, if you scored over 350, you were automatically accepted to any college in Florida. So I wound up going to University of South Florida. They just opened up a medical school because I intended to be a doctor from the time I was a kid. Number one, because, you know, I'd been sick a lot, and these guys always seemed to know what the hell was going on, you know, and would get me better. Number two, when people talk about that hole they're trying to fill with drugs and alcohol, for me that hole was unhappiness, because I had a very unhappy childhood. And my goal in life was to be happy. And, you know, I thought the best way I could do that was to be a doctor. Because I had this crazy notion in my head that they taught you how to fix people. And I knew I was screwed up. I knew I wasn't normal, you know. And I said, I'll go to medical school. You know, they'll tell me how to fix myself. You know, that's why my drinking and stuff never bothered me. I never drank like a normal person. I never did drugs like a normal person. And I didn't care. Because I knew I wasn't normal. Why the hell should I drink like a normal person? Why would I do anything normal? So anyway, South Florida just opened up their medical school, and I said, well, okay, you know, I'm going to go there. So because of these classes I had taken in high school, I was able to waive all the first-year requirements. Basically, I started as a sophomore. I joined a fraternity, even though I was a hippie, because fraternities, they love to drink, you know. And I had the fraternity for drinking, and I had my hippie friends for the drugs. You know, the best of both worlds. So, of course, unfortunately, this didn't really help me with my academic focus. I left the University of South Florida at the end of 2 years with another perfect 2.0. And just to show you how those things kind of work, I took this class when I was in my sophomore year. Was a class called Microtechniques. It's a histology class. It was a 500-level class, even though, you know, in college they have all these different 100, 200, 300, 400. So I was taking this 500-level class in histology, and it was 50% of your grade was lecture and 50% was lab. And the lecture had a midterm and a final. The lab had no tests. You made 50 slides over the course of a semester, and then you turned in your slides at the end and they graded them. And you had to make slides of all these different tissues and bones, and you stained them to show up, you know, muscle tissue or ribosomes or these little intercellular structures. But it was great because in order to stain tissue, you have to get rid of the water. And the way you get rid of the water is with grain alcohol. And you start with these baths of 10%, then 20, then 30, then 40, then 50, then 60, then 80, all the way up to 100%. So, and right outside the lab, I love that lab, was a vending machine with that happened to have grape knee-high. Now, there some people argue with me in AA, because I said, you know, I called this drink Grape Dehi and Grain, Purple Jesus. But there are people in AA who say that really Purple Jesus is grain alcohol and grape Kool-Aid. Well, you know, I'm not going to argue the point, you know, whatever. You know, it was called grain it was called Purple Jesus because if you drink enough, you see God. And if you drink more, you are God. Would be the short and sweet of that. Anyway, about halfway through the semester, the teaching assistant made an announcement to the class. He said, you know, we have this 5 gallons of grain alcohol. It's supposed to last all year. And here it's half a semester, and it's almost gone. No thanks in small part to my efforts to be a good person and do what I could. So anyway, I failed the midterm. And just at towards the end of the final part of the semester, I had 5 slides out of 50. So during this period of time, I was also quite fond of amphetamines. I loved amphetamines. You know, you could drink a lot doing amphetamines. So I walked into the lab on a Thursday morning, and I walked out of the lab on a Tuesday evening. I turned in my 50 slides, got a C, and I aced the final. And I got a C for the class, hence my perfect 2.0. So, at that point, I realized that, well, you know, you're really not getting things done like you need to go to medical school. So I decided to relocate to Los Angeles. And, when I want to be, I am one of those driven, compulsive, focused people. They talk about alcoholics being selfish and self-centered. Me to the hill when I want to be. And I wanted to be. So I moved to L.A. I started over again. I went to California State University, Los Angeles, for 6 years. I was working in hospitals at night. I worked from 11 at night till 7 in the morning. I went to school from 8 in the morning till 4 in the afternoon. I studied from 4 to 6. I relaxed from 6 to 7, and I slept from 7 to 10. And I did that for 6 years. And I wasn't really drinking a lot because I was, again, broke. I didn't have any money, you know, between school and everything. I was smoking a lot of pot. Because there was a saying at the time that said, pot will get you through times of no money better than money will get you through times of no pot. And I had no money. So the obvious solution was pot. So in any case, following that period of time, I tried applying to some American medical schools, but because I was considered older than average because no matter what you do, and I'd done real well in L.A., I still had these 2 years from South Florida, you know, on my transcript, so I couldn't get in. So I started looking around, you know, saying, well, what am I going to do? So I decided I was going to go to a foreign medical school. You know, I looked in the Philippines. I looked in Mexico. I said, well, man, you know, you got to learn a foreign language, a long way to travel, you know, Mexico, there's banditos, and they got guys with machine guns outside the medical school, you know, this just isn't cool. So I found this school in Grenada, St. George's University School of Medicine, SCUSM, which we said stands for SCUSME. British colony, everybody spoke English, you know, English was the language. Stable government, said, I'm going to Grenada. So my father, who, of course, you have not heard much about throughout up till this point, because I did finally get into medical school, agreed to pay for me to go to Grenada. So I went to Grenada, you know, and of course, 3 months after I get there, they have a revolution. And the Cubans invade. So that's what they talk about, you know, the best laid plans of men and mice. In any case, you know, it didn't really interrupt the education. I'm talking kind of fast and running through things because I don't want to run over. So I went to Grenada, was down in the islands for 2.5 years, and back up in the States for another 2 years. By this time, I'd moved to Baltimore to find a place to do my residency, which I did at Greater Baltimore Medical Center in internal medicine. Your residency is 36 months. Normally, when you're doing a residency like that, you spend about 6 months in ICU, CCU, and the rest of the time you're on the wards. I was really, I'm a sick guy. You know, I love dead and dying people. What can I say? You know, I like to be where there's action. I like to be, you know, in the firestorm. I spent, out of 36 months, I spent 16 months in ICU and CCU. While I was there, when I had a chance, my first year, I did an elective at a place in Baltimore called Shock Trauma. I was an intern, and I was on the neurotrauma unit. Everybody else that I was there that month with was at least a third-year resident. And I had 3 months' experience as an intern. But I did the month there. They treated me exactly the same as everybody else. That was when I said I was a resitern. I was an intern functioning as a resident. At the end of that month, they came back and said, you want to come back next year and do a month in CCRU. CCRU was the Critical Care Recovery Unit. It's the highest level of care in the state of Maryland. When you leave CCRU, you get transferred to the ICU. So these people were, like, majorly fucked up. And I said, sure. So second year, I'm a second-year resident. I go back, and I do a month in CCRU. I found out later I was one of only two people that had ever been allowed to work in CCRU that hadn't completed a residency. At the end of that month, they said they offered me a contract to do my fellowship at Shock Trauma, which I, of course, took. Normally, you don't apply for a fellowship until the end of your third year. But here it was halfway through my second year, and I already had a fellowship. So I did my year at Shock Trauma. And then, of course, I always wanted to come back to Florida. So I wound up moving back to Kissimmee. Unfortunately, you know, there wasn't a lot of opportunity for intensivists, which is what I had trained for, specializing in critical care, ICU, and that. So I started off doing private practice and worked in the ER part-time. I should mention I've been married 3 times. My first 2 marriages did not end because of anything related to drinking or drugs. My marriages ended because I was an asshole. You know, I was selfish. I was self-centered. I was focused. I was driven. It's kind of funny, you know. Men want sex, as far as I've been able to understand in my time on Earth. Men want sex. Women want relationships. Men want just enough of a relationship to have sex. And then things kind of stop. Women kind of look at sex as being the start of a relationship. Men look at it as the end. So, in any case, you know, I was working during this period of time. I was working 120 hours a week. And when I came home, you know, I really was not the best person to be in a relationship with. I did do a little drinking during this period of time, but I really couldn't drink a lot because, believe me, when working the way I was working, the hours I was putting in, one drink and I was asleep. You know, it was just that simple, man. I was burned to the bone. So in any case, I moved to Kissimmee. I was on my second marriage at that time. The first one had kind of blown up during my internship, and then I got married again in my second year of residency. So, I'm in private practice for about a year and a half, and I'm working the ER part-time, and I am totally unhappy. Now, like I said, you know, the whole thing about my life was I wanted to be happy. I have this what I call the Rubik's Cube theory of happiness, that if you just find the right woman, the right house, the right amount of money, just like that Rubik's Cube, poof, you're happy. And I was convinced that of this theory. And that's why I kept changing wives and houses. So at this point, you know, I'm totally unhappy. So, and I will stop at nothing in order to be happy. So I said, what am I going to do? Well, so obvious. Divorce my wife, close the practice, declare bankruptcy, go to work ER full time. And that was really when things started taking off. I'd been relatively in check until then. When you work the ER, it's great. Just like working a regular job, you know, you work your shift, you go home, you're not on call, you have no responsibility. You know, I was 40 years old, and I said, you know, it's time for me to enjoy myself. That's what the problem. I need to enjoy myself. You know, because by then I had realized that going to medical school does not teach you how to fix yourself, unfortunately. So that, you know, that hadn't panned out the way I wanted it to, but I still had my Rubik's Cube theory of happiness going, so, you know. So I started partying, you know. I had a shoebox that I kept $3,000 in cash in the trunk of my car. I get off work, I go home, change clothes, take a shower, and I was ready to party, man. I was hitting the clubs. You know, I'd walk in with a wad of cash, throwing money everywhere. Yeah. Everybody knew my name. Bartenders loved me. You know, I've never been thrown out of a bar or a club, no matter how much I drank. And that's because you got to tip well. You know, that is the key. Tip well. You know, my drinking was really, really getting going. In fact, it got to the point where I would only stay in a bar for an hour. Because if I stayed longer an hour, they'd realize how much I was drinking. Because I wasn't content with a drink. You know, it had to be a double. And then I was ordering double-doubles. Two drinks at one time, both doubles. And I was doing that because I'm considerate. I didn't want to be bothering the bartender or the waitress a lot. You know, I was thinking of her. It wasn't for me. You know. But you know, after about an hour, I had to go because the bartender would be going, whoa, what's this guy doing? And I'd move on, you know. Eventually, I remarried. This time, it was actually a woman I loved. You know, we got another house, and things are going well. You know, I mean, I'm really doing well in my career. I'm making lots of money. You know, enough money for any sane person, which I was not, to certainly be happy. You know, at my peak, I was making about $22,000 to $25,000 a month. And I was totally unhappy. I was miserable. I couldn't figure out what to do. I was stuck. I had done everything since I was 14 years old. I had done everything I could to be happy. That's all I wanted. All I wanted was to be happy. And I had failed. That was crushing to me. I mean, I'm married to a woman I love. I got a nice house. I got a great career. I'm making good money. And I am friggin' miserable. And I had nothing left. I'd run out of options. I'd run out of ideas. And the only thing left was to drink. Now, I tell people, you know, if drinking made me happy, I'd still be drinking. But my drinking had nothing to do with being making me happy. My drinking, I figured, fuck it. You know, if I can't be happy, at least I'll drink and I won't care. Alcohol made it so I didn't care. But, you know, it gets progressive. And they talk about in the big book, you know, that that line that we all cross sooner or later. And for me, that was in March of 2002 when the medical director for the emergency room group I was working with called me in his office and said, Ken, we've had some anonymous, they always tell you that anonymous shit. They know who it was, you know, but anonymous. I said, what is this, AA? Anonymity? So he said, we've had some anonymous reports of people think they smelled alcohol in your breath. And I knew I had crossed that invisible line, you know, because I always went by airline pilot's rules. Never had to drink 8 hours before I had to be at work. Now, of course, I could drink a lot before that 8 hours. That's why when I chair meetings and I qualify, the only way I qualify never changes, because it never changes that I'm the fact that I'm an alcoholic. I drank as much as I could, as fast as I could, for as long as I could. So anyway, when that happened, you know, medicine's a funny place. You know, despite what you see on, if you watch MASH or things like that, you know, you can party, but you know, there's a point that you don't cross, and I crossed that point. So, you know, I was told I had to go into treatment, and I was not happy about going to treatment. But I didn't have a choice. I went. I was over at Healthcare Connections in Tampa for 5 weeks. Came back, you know, started working again, and, of course, going to meetings. I've been in the program 8 years, but I only have 7 years and 3 months of sobriety. When I came back from treatment, I was still kind of pissed off, you know. What am I going to do now? I'm still unhappy, and I can't drink, you know. But I made a year, picked up my one-year chip, but I didn't have a sponsor. I didn't work the steps. So I went back out. Fortunately, it was just for a brief period. One day I said, you know, screw it. You know, I got a little miniature, one of those little airline miniatures, lemonade, mixed them together, drank it. Nothing happened. I said, great. I'm doing good. So a few days go by. I go back to that same liquor store. I get two miniatures and a bottle of lemonade. Mix them. Drink them. Nothing happened. I said, I'm good. This is going well. So I said, well, maybe miniatures, you know, I don't want to keep going back. Let's get a half pint. Half pint? The way I'm drinking now, that half pint's going to last, God, a month. So, of course, that half pint lasted about 3 days. So I said, well, maybe we need a pint. Yeah, that's a pint. That'll last a month. So, of course, and my wife didn't know I'd started drinking again. I was keeping that from her. She went to bed one night, and I said, oh, it's okay, you go to bed. I'm going to stay up and read. And went out to my Jeep, got that pint, going to just have a little drink. Pint's gone. And I saw that progression. And I'd been in the program long enough. You know, I said, oh, this is bad. And that was it for me, you know. That was, like I said, a little over 7 years ago. I went back to the same meeting where I got my one-year medallion. I picked up a white chip. I got a sponsor. I started working the steps. And then the strangest thing happened. I became happy. I couldn't figure it. Because if somebody had told me that in order to be happy, I had to get sober and develop a relationship with a higher power, I would have told them they were out of their fucking mind. There was no way that could work. But it did. And it's been a blessing, you know, because it's really the only thing I want in my life. And I finally got it through AA. And don't get me wrong, as Liz knows, sobriety, things haven't been great in sobriety. My wife developed metastatic breast cancer. She was ill for about 4 years before she died. It was financially devastating. Illnesses like that tend to do that. That's why I wound up working for the health department. I needed the health insurance benefits through them. Plus, I needed a regular kind of job, Monday through Friday type stuff, not doing the weekends, nights, and everything like you do when you're working the ER, which required I took a 60% pay cut to do that. But it was worth it, you know. And I wouldn't have gotten through that without AA. You know, I'm extremely grateful because everything I have wanted all my life, I finally have. And it's all because of AA. And that's all I have to share.
Thank you.